Hello, and welcome to The Spark. I'm Matt, and by the grace of the Nashville Public Library, I'm here to talk about the creative process and the joy of appreciating the creations of others. Thankfully, I'm not going to do it alone. Joining me today is a lawyer by day, stand-up comedian by night, frequenting open mic nights around the city. It's Katie Hill.
Hi.
Hello, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So what was your most recent open mic night? Have you had one in the last couple weeks?
Yes. I went last night to Why Not Saloon in Belmead. It is a cleanish mic that they have every Wednesday night earlier in the evening. So it starts at 6. Well, sign-ups at 6. They start the show at 6:30.
Mm-hmm. So I have two questions.
Yeah.
Clean-ish.
Clean-ish. It has to go over the heads of kids.
Oh.
So you can make jokes that are a little bit iffy. And some people push the line. Some people just forget about the line. Mm-hmm. They're not dragging anyone off stage as far as I've seen, but... It's definitely an environment where you're more aware of what you're saying. You're not doing your worst material. You're saying heck instead of H-E double hockey sticks. And so it's a bit more family friendly.
Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a lot of this where I know nothing about this space.
Oh, well, good, because I barely know anything.
Right. But I was surprised to hear that the signups are that day, that evening.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that pretty universal where it's like now?
Yes. The majority of open mics in Nashville, you're getting a spot ahead of time by either being an out-of-towner or a bringer, which is somebody who you're guaranteeing that you're going to bring someone else to the show who's not a comic. Mm. That can get you a spot ahead of time. But the majority of open mics, as far as I've done in Nashville, are show up, you put your name on a list or you put your name on a slip of paper, and it's either show up, go up, first come, first serve, or bucket pull. Where they're just pulling people's names out of literally a bucket or a hat or whatever they've got on hand and saying, all right, these are our comics for tonight. And so sometimes you show up to places and put your name down and wait, and you do not get a spot, and you decide whether to stay and support like a good little comic or go home and work on your material.
And in a not bucket-based scenario, is there some semblance of like when you're going to go?
Yeah. I mean, you just show up and put your name on the list and often somebody's got a scrap of paper or something and you might see, oh, okay, if you've gotten there early, you might have your pick of the litter. You can pick wherever you want on the list. Mm. But most of the time, people will just put their name at the top and then everyone will kind of shuffle in underneath. And a lot of the mics, they don't necessarily limit it. Some of them will say, look, we only got this many slots. We got to figure out whether or not we should go to a bucket pool system because of how popular it's becoming. But a lot of them are what we call show up, go up. Mm. So if you show up, put your name down, they'll call you up at a certain time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
Well, okay. I will say it is interesting that public speaking is one of people's greatest fears. Mm. And yet there are people clamoring every week for a chance to do some more of it.
Right. So as you alluded to, this is a fairly new endeavor for you.
Oh, my gosh. I feel brand new to it. I started November of last year. Mm. But, yeah, no, I've just – something else happened in November of last year that made me think, why am I waiting around to see if I'm qualified or not for any sort of position? I've always wanted to try this out. Why don't I go try it out? And I've loved doing it ever since. Mm.
And more background for the listener. We've known each other for several years.
Yes, we have.
So I can confirm that like some of the things that I presume are prerequisites, i.e. being funny and engaging, you already have.
Oh, well, that you have to say that. I'm paying you. No, that's very sweet. I'd like to think of myself as someone who not just has a good sense of humor, but is able to be funny, which I've had to really learn the distinction between those two. Mm. But if you want to see if you're funny or not, an open mic's actually not where to test that out. It's more so whether or not you can win over a crowd.
Right.
Yeah.
I have so many different questions about entering that space, but the
thing. My gosh, that's why I'm here.
The thing that keeps coming to front of mind is that I watched a thing many years ago in which some YouTubers were wanting to try getting into stand-up via some other YouTuber friends they knew who were running that circuit.
Sure.
And they were told and found it true very quickly that, as with many skills, but perhaps more notably with a sort of public speaking focused skill, they were told that stand-up's going to be a thing you're bad at.
for a while.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have seen some people that I'm like, oh my gosh, they're such a natural at it. And what I'm not seeing is the hours that they've put into just honing some jokes. Mm. And it's so tricky too, because every room is different. A lot of open mics are rooms full of other comedians.
Right.
And so that alone is a little bit intimidating, because people think, oh, I'm going to go up and these things are hilarious. They've killed around the water cooler at work. And two big mistakes on that is I see people make. One of them is that they forget that everyone else in their life has context. Everyone else knows them to a certain degree, knows the background to a joke. Like if I said to you, oh my gosh, Lane punched someone in the face the other day. You know Lane. You know the context. You know that that's crazy. Whereas if I said that to a crowd, they'd go, okay, and? And that's one of the hardest things, is giving context without feeling like you're over-explaining stuff all the time.
Yeah.
But that, and also people think, oh, I'm the funniest guy in my friend group. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go kill. And then they get up and say something that every single person in that room has said at one point in time as a hack joke. And nothing wrong with a hack joke. It'll get laughs when it needs to get laughs, but then it doesn't, and then they panic.
Yeah.
And so much of comedy, from what I've experienced, is just going, okay, next joke.
So before we get too far away from it, what was the appeal for you? Like, what drew you to trying this?
Oh, gosh. I feel like it's so many things. That's one of the beautiful things about this podcast, is I got to think about all the things that you might ask, and I was like, he's gonna ask why I did it.
I've been read.
Yes. I have to be prepared. I know part of why I initially wanted to do it is because it seemed fun. Just baseline, I have loved comedy from a young age. I was always that annoying child who people wanted to watch a movie, and I was like, well, why don't we watch, I don't know, Jim Gaffigan's next stand-up special. And they're like, well, haven't you already seen that? And I'm like, I think watching it with you guys would be fun. And it was for me. And I adored stand-up comedy. I loved listening to all different types of comics and thinking, okay, if I got up and tried to make a joke. And I am somebody who, I wasn't ever class clown because I was too anxious for that. But I always love making other people laugh. But it is a hard line to ride of like, okay, don't be too attention-seeking, don't be too much, don't be too loud. And I grew up with parents who were so sweet and so kind, but really were like, hey, you need to be a little more quiet, you need to be a little more reserved. And so it's sort of one of the avenues as I got older where I thought, but like, why do I have to be those things? And so what if this is an outlet? What if this is just something I do and it gets it out of my system? And shocker, it doesn't. It makes it worse. I am now trying material on people all the time, constantly. So if anyone's looking and like going, oh, well, this will get it out of somebody's system, it won't. It won't. It'll only spark it further. But I wanted to try it out. It looked fun, and I thought I would like it. And turns out I did. It's not always fun. There's plenty of times where you bomb or you tell a joke in a way that you're like, I was not funny. But it's 4 minutes, open mics. You get up, you do your time, you sit back down, you come back the next day. I think more opportunities for things like that. I want there to be a quicker turnover of like, okay, fail, do it again.
Quicker than what it is, or quicker in other sort of avenues?
Oh, quicker than other avenues, I would say. Just because so many projects that people work on, you have to really show. Like if I paint a picture, then I have to work on it, work on it, work on it, work on it. And then I might be sitting there going, this isn't what I want it to be. And do I try again on the same picture, or do I start another picture? And I've found ways to make art in that category more so, okay, try again, try again. Otherwise, I get too discouraged. I'm like, oh, I'm not good enough at this. I have to immediately find a different thing to do. But comedy has been one of those things where I would walk away and go, oh, I didn't do that right. I didn't like what I said. I can't wait to try again.
And you're getting instant feedback.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You get pretty instant feedback. You can get booed.
But has that happened yet?
If it has, I ignored it. I'm sure someone in their heart was booing.
Right.
But they've gotten real quiet before. I've had to go, ooh, okay, next joke.
So this is a thing in terms of like, all right, come back next day. Mm-hmm. When I was texting you about doing this, we hadn't talked about you doing comedy for a minute, wanted to make sure it was still something you were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you mentioned like, yeah, I've only been doing like one a week. It's like, only?
Yeah, there are people out here doing multiple every single night.
Oh my gosh.
And granted, those people are probably pursuing full careers in comedy, and right now I'm just a hobbyist. Mm-hmm. But there are people that you show up and they only see you once a week and they go, oh, it's been a minute since I've seen you. You're like, I know what this is. But
that like show of dominance?
Some of them really are just asking.
Okay.
Of like, oh, it's been a minute. How's it going? Making sure you're okay. A lot of people are very, very supportive in the comedy community. And I mean, like with any artistic endeavor, you're going to meet people who they're not there to make friends. Mm-hmm. But I think the name of my memoir one day is I'm Here to Make Friends. Because every environment I walk into, I'm like, hey, how's it going? What are we doing tonight? Mm-hmm. And I've made some really sweet friends who I think are also there to make friends.
Good.
Yeah.
Certainly the first thing I thought of when you mentioned that a lot of times open mics are going to be you telling jokes to almost exclusively other comics. I was given immediate flashbacks to like writing classes in college. And the sort of peer review that happens in those spaces.
Oh, yeah.
And, boy, sometimes it's not good.
People sometimes just want to have a critique mm-hmm. because they feel like this is going to make them seem smarter or more established. And so after a while, you know who that person is going to be. I think when you're starting out, it's really hard to not take every critique as gospel, where you're like, okay, what is funny? And it's so tricky because people are going to have some really good points and you might think, well, I thought it was funny, but everyone's saying, well, that's not your best work. Mm. But then you have to develop out of that a sense of, actually, I think this is funny, even if other people don't. And I just need to find who else thinks is funny. Now, I would like to go back to the fact that I am not an established comic and there are people who are so many more people that I could have given you the names up to invite on your show that you can in the future. But I would like to think I can read people a little bit. And so I have really appreciated the people watching at comedy shows is amazing. Because you don't even have to watch that hard. They're getting up there and telling you everything.
True.
But it's all the stuff that they're not telling you that I think is so interesting of what they're emphasizing or what they think is funny or what like their jokes that they always go back to versus the person who gets up who there's a local comic, Joe Collins, that I don't think I've ever seen her do the same set twice. And I think that is incredible. And people have all different opinions, all different views of it. And I don't know what her path is. Like, I don't know if she's looking to be on a main stage one day or if this is like something she's doing amongst all these other things. I know she also has a bunch of other things that she does. But every time she gets up, it's something new. And I at first was like, I was watching other people talk about, well, you really need to get a couple, like you need to get a tight 15 and then you need to hone those jokes. And then I saw her doing it. I was like, I like that one better. I like what she's doing more. And so I still have like some go-to jokes that I'll go back and be like, all right, I want to work on this. But I always try to add something new every time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's certainly a conversation that happens, I think, especially around visual art. This idea that like you have to develop, quote unquote, your style.
Yeah.
And there was a adjunct professor at the art department at Belmont who at one point was like, I never did that. And I am a commercially successful illustrator. I just suit the style to the project.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that idea that in any creative thing, there is no one path.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's interesting too, because whenever there is a comic that becomes big. So for example, of course, the big Nashville comic right now is Nate Bargatze. He's clean, family friendly. You can put him on any stage. He'll do well. I mean, he's paid his dues. He's been doing this for decades. And he's so well known and so well loved. You go to any open mic, you'll see someone doing a Nate Bargatze. You'll see, and same with Shane Gillis. He's big name. And people will pick up their mannerisms or do similar styles. And there are some people that are very critical of, oh, this person's just getting up here and copying someone. And I always say, are they stealing their jokes? Or are they just finding their rhythm? Because everyone thinks they're going to be the most original person. I'm like, you're not gonna like that. You might find your niche. You might find your thing that someone goes, I've never seen that before. But it might just be because they don't know all the history of it. Some people become their own gatekeepers. And I still can be in a lot of ways where I'm like, oh, I can't show up to this until I've earned this or I've done this. But if you're invited, show up. If I'm invited to a podcast as a comic, I'm going to show up and do the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like the sort of there's nothing new under the sun idea for a lot of people is an indictment. But for me, it's a relief. Like, oh, the weight of being truly original can be removed from me.
Because
I'm just a bundle of memories and experiences.
Absolutely. I mean, what is it? Lion King is just Hamlet. Like, there's so many things. It's like, doesn't mean it's not great. Now, granted, am I recreating Hamlet? Absolutely. I'm recreating my childhood memories and trauma. I'm not nothing new about that. But it is, I think the more you just lean into the fact that you're not going to be perfect, and the more you lean into, I'm here to have a good time, then the more you will. And granted, nothing is fair. That was advice I got from Drew Davis, the leader of the Clean Comedy Collective in Nashville. He's a really solid guy. He also runs the Excel spreadsheet that has all the open mics on it that any of the comics can check at any time to know what are the open mics and what are the booked mics during the week. An incredible resource.
I was going to say, you're welcome, everyone else. My goodness.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And he is someone who told me when I first started out, he said, comedy isn't fair. Once you get over that, you'll have way more fun. And I thought, interesting advice, but good, solid, good to know. And I think that's one of those things of like, it's reassuring. Yeah. Comedy isn't fair. You're going to show up places and someone's going to get a spot you thought you deserved. There'll be people thinking, I should have been on the Nashville Public Library's podcast. The more you have fun with it, the better of a time you'll have. I know that sounds redundant, but I think it's hard not to get pulled into the mindset of anything becoming a job. I do that with so many things. I do that with video games where I realize 2 hours into a playthrough is something I'm like, I'm not even having fun anymore. I've turned this into my new part-time job and I have to be the best at it. And I have to be the most efficient resource collector Horizon has ever seen. And then I realized I've put that pressure on myself as opposed to what the game is there for. Same with like group games. I can quickly turn into, well, if I'm not winning, what am I doing here? It's like bonding with friends and family. I'm like, not enough. I have to prove something.
This is going to sound like sacrilege. That was me with Skyrim.
Oh, I'm sure it was a lot of people with Skyrim.
Yeah, because like I realized many hours into the game, not that many for Skyrim.
Yes.
But not inconsequential. Like, my hands are just doing this. My hands are just doing this, and I'm following the compass around with no compunction, no desires.
Yeah, there's a checkbox in the upper corner, and I'm doing it, and I find the next thing on the list, and I do it.
And don't get it twisted. I'm a guy who chooses to shelve books at a library. I find checklists remarkably satisfying.
It actually is very soothing.
But not all checklists.
Not all checklists are created equal.
No.
So what did you do to break yourself out of that?
I stopped playing.
Okay.
I just quit Skyrim.
You took your ball and went home.
Yeah, because like at that point, the only other sort of Bethesda mainline game I had played was Fallout 3.
And very different.
Yeah, but also still very much that vibe and, and a similar idea of like, here's this huge world to traverse and many different quest lines to follow using a lot of the same systems. I mean, yeah, Skyrim doesn't have VATs.
Yes.
But I felt like the thing that stopped me playing more Skyrim was very much a, I had the Bethesda experience I wanted from Fallout 3.
Yeah.
And I'm good. And I can move on.
I think being able to move on, being able to quit things is such a gift. Because not to go into like, oh, the sunk cost fallacy. But so much of people's lives is, oh, but I've committed to this. And granted, is it good to commit to things? I believe so. I think there's something noble and valiant about people who say, you know, even when it's hard, even when it doesn't feel rewarding, I have a reason why I'm committed to something. But if the why is because I bought this game, then that's a real low bar. Jump right over that.
Right.
Cancel that. Like, quit that. Because there, and I think the same thing for hobbies of, I try to say to myself, is there a way I can scale this back? And that was how it was with comedy, is I got into it so hard because whenever I jump into thing, I'm a little too obsessive. I'm sure my exes can tell you that. No, just kidding. I'm happily married. Shout out to Ben. I get a little too obsessive at first. And so I was like going to every single open mic and like five times a week and all that. And it helped that Ben was in full swing of his band practice at the time. So I had a lot of time in the evenings and was starting off going to all of the mics, jumping into everything. And then I quickly found that life happened. Work popped up, things got in the way. And I started getting into that mindset of, oh, I need to get these tasks. I need to do this. I need to get better at this. I need to see progress. I need to have growth measurables. I need to have a KIP. And I quickly realized, oh, this is starting to not be as fun because I've turned it into a side job. And I can see all the ways I'm not good enough at it. But I still really wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay, I'm scaling it back for a bit. Just go in once or twice a week. It's okay if I don't hit a mic during a week. Stuff happens. And once I got past that hurdle of I can really pick this up or put it down at any time, it made me go to more mics. Because I was like, oh, well, I don't have to do any of this. And I don't know if that's just my own compulsive brain set or if I have something someone would diagnose. Don't tell me. But I think it helped when it became... Learning to have a hobby is hard sometimes.
Oh, yeah. And the pressure aspect is incredibly real. I have a writing degree.
Yeah.
I want to write. I have always wanted to write.
Of
and
course.
I barely do it.
And well, why don't you?
Exactly.
Are you wasting your life?
Exactly. And that became the thing that stopped me in a lot of instances.
Yep.
Was a lot of different creative stuff, there is this messaging that if it isn't the most important thing to you, why are you doing it?
Yeah, you're not passionate enough.
Right. And I think that is a bias that comes from the fact that the loudest voices you're going to hear talk about a pursuit are the people who have dedicated their lives to it and probably make good money from doing it.
Absolutely. The people who are on their third divorce. No, not everybody's like that. There are people who have balanced lives who are also incredibly just skilled or committed to things, but those are exceptions to the rule.
Mm. And this idea of finding your level of satisfaction with the thing.
I think that's what people forget is it's a mental illness. Like to get up and I already stand up in front of people and talk a lot of the time. The idea that I in my free time also then go, you know what? I'm not done with people hearing me today. I want them to hear my dumb little jokes about whatever I've thought of, about my sister having 8 hamsters in 2 years back when we were growing up. I think that should be on an FBI watch list and in the minds of this poor bar owners for the rest of the day. And I appreciate that. I think that everyone should find the thing that they like, and it shouldn't be have to be this like magnificent calling of like, I just knew the moment my eyes opened or I saw this thing or saw this person. I think it's the thing that you look at that everyone goes, I could never. And you go, oh, I could. I could try it out. Try that.
The most succinct version of this that a Tumblr user whose handle I never learned and never would never be able to remember served to me.
I love a deep Tumblr cut.
Is this idea that people have been making things forever.
Yes.
As long as there have been people, people have been making things. And boy, howdy, was it not about getting good at it? And was it not about making money from it?
I think, obviously, yeah, be mindful of what you do. But I think there is something to be said for whenever you're doing something, what is your why? And if your why is, well, I don't know, I just want people to like me, then heads up, you are going to fail. Even if you succeed. Even if you become the most liked painter, speaker, musician. It's not forever. And it might not be for the reasons you like. You ever met an artist who has a song that popped off? They show up to every concert and people are yelling, sing this song. And they're like, I'll get to it. I want to do my other stuff.
So you talked about people absorbing sort of tendencies and mannerisms and things from the people that they like. Have you felt that happening to you? And if yes, do you like tamp it or let that happen?
I think I will naturally always tend towards certain people, not just because they were my upbringing, like Brian Regan, but you know Brian Regan?
Oh, yeah. I was launched back to some very early stick figure YouTube videos.
Oh, gosh,
yes. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, made my family watch them on repeat. They were so good. And thing is, he's still a classic.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he was family friendly, grown up in a Christian household. I was allowed to watch him and show his videos to others. Mm-hmm. I was allowed to talk about him publicly. My mom didn't have to go, don't tell people.
Right.
But I loved him. But I quickly found my style wasn't going to be Brian Regan's style because he does this very, like, I don't want to say screamy, because that's not his thing, but a very exaggerated voice.
Yeah, kind of a bellow.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's like this real guttural, like, wah! Mm-hmm. And it's so good and it fits him so well. But it's sort of like trying on clothes.
Mm.
I think middle schoolers get a bad rap, mostly because they deserve it. But also because they are the worst. But the reason they're the worst is because they don't know who they are yet.
No.
And so they're trying on 1,000 different personalities, mostly from influencers or streamers who shouldn't be allowed to make money the way they do.
Or when we were children, cartoons.
Cartoon, yes. The amount of kids in middle school who thought they were SpongeBob.
Ooh.
That, people forget that. But that makes me feel a little bit better because people are like, oh, kids are just now trying to be Mr. Beast or whatever. I'm like, people in my grade were trying to be Naruto and SpongeBob.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to be Teen Titans Robin in all of his angstiness.
I can see that.
Oh,
I
no.
can see. Oh, my gosh. I bet you. I felt like that. I'm trying to think. Kim Possible was definitely one of those people I latched onto.
I think she's a pretty good one.
She's a fantastic one.
Yeah, because she learns a lot of stuff. She's not perfect. I mean, obviously, this is the joke of the show, where she's, like, incredible at anything not relevant to being 14.
Yes.
And then everything else is hard.
Yes. Well, and that was so relatable, because I was achievement-based at that age. And, and then
at
also... All right. I see where this is going. You think you're funny. No, you are.
I say it because I see it in the mirror, my dude.
All right. Yeah, that is. Well, and part of me is like, very few people aren't achievement-based. It's just how they measure their achievements, which is the same convo I had with my therapist, where she's like, well, I feel like we're leaning a lot into our identity with achievements. I'm like, well, who doesn't? You've got a certificate on your wall. Like... Yeah, that's always fun arguing with your therapist. But yes, definitely going back to the principle of, do you find yourself in comedians or do you see patterns emerge where you're copying or mirroring certain comedians? Absolutely. I think some of it is almost intentional because it is like trying on clothes. It's trying on personality, like the middle schooler. And you just have to be the worst for a bit. You have to be somebody who you're like, everything feels hacky. Everything feels like something someone's done before. I'm telling jokes that, are these even funny? And the thing I've done is I try to film myself whenever I'm doing open mics. And then I also try to find clips of it that I liked. Sometimes I can't. And then I put them on my Instagram, which Katie Hill Comedy, follow me on Instagram and our TikTok. I started doing that because I wanted to see growth. I wanted to kind of see, and I wanted to hold myself accountable to, I'm still going to keep doing this, even if I don't think I'm the funniest person. And so I've posted stuff sometimes where I'm like, I don't know if that's very funny. I don't think that's my best work. I don't think that's great. But I realized that if I always hold out for what I think is, quote, my best work, I'm never going to do anything. Because I can look at things, and I, as someone who's appreciated comedy my whole life, I can look at it and go, that's good. That's really good versus, that's not my favorite. And people have their own options and people have their own preferences, but I don't really feel like that joke landed. And so I'm super critical with myself. And I already know I'm hypercritical with myself way more than I am with anyone else. And so I thought if I was advising a friend what to do, what would I tell her? And it's like, I would tell her just post it. And it doesn't matter what anyone else says or thinks unless somebody's like, hey, that was offensive. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll actually examine that.
Right.
But I find myself more drawn to probably the conversational humorous. So like a big name right now is Mike Birbiglia. I love his storytelling aspect where he goes through and you really get to know him, at least the side of him that he shows. I love Gary Goldman. He's somebody who has been very open with his struggle with depression. And overcoming that in his family history. And he has his own opinions. He draws his own lines, but it's always in a very caring way. He's not somebody who punches down. I think that is something that I've always been drawn to with the comedians I love, is they're not people who punch down. And I know some people argue, well, a comedian, you're already very low. Who do you punch down to? But a lot of comedians have become like superstars nowadays. That's the craziest thing. is there comedians that are like celebrities? And I'm thinking, comedian is supposed to be low. Like, comedian
right.
is not supposed to be. Well, and I mean, supposed to be. What is supposed to be? But I always thought of comedian as like, yeah, you're the class clown. You're the person who's willing to be laughed at.
And certainly that seems to be the sort of cultural weight, is that like they're typically people of the people.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. You got to be relatable.
Go back to something that was really popular when we were younger, like blue collar comedy tour type
idea
of like
yeah.
the fact that that was the framing of it, of like, we are just normal dudes.
Well, and that's the craziest thing about it, too, is, I mean, Ron White's still doing comedy, and he has actually gotten sober. And so his comedy is still dirty as before. But it is cool to see somebody kind of having overcome that who's still in the comedy world. Larry the Cable Guy doesn't have a Southern accent.
No.
Which is hysterical. I mean, I think nowadays if someone tried that, people might not take it to it as much as they used to.
Right.
Because it would feel too much like a caricature.
True.
And then I say that and I'm like, no, I've seen people get on TikTok every day and be like, here's what my grandpa sounds like. And it's like, as long as you can kind of draw it back, people are looking more and more in comedy, I think, for an authentic experience. And so a little bit, people still do it, but a little bit gone are the days where people would get up and just do a whole story about stuff that doesn't exist or stories that aren't true. More and more so, I've seen crowds want to hear a true story, at least in North America. I don't know. I can't speak. I think the British comedians that I still watch are still a little bit like pantomime-ish, but that's just the strong influences of it. Whereas a lot of the U.S. comedians I'm watching, especially, like, look at, like, Josh Johnson, a writer for The Daily Show, comedian. He does this thing where he writes for The Daily Show throughout the week and then on the weekends, like, tours.
Oh, gosh.
And he puts up, like, a YouTube video every week. And he's killing it. And it's always about current stuff. It's always new material. He's a machine. Like, and not in, like, oh, he's just, an AI robot sort of sense that machine now carries nowadays. But he is so well-versed and fine-tuned at his craft. He's the kind of comedian that people watch and go, I probably shouldn't be doing comedy. Like, he's so good at it.
Right.
You realize how quickly, how far you have to climb. But he is somebody who, he gets up and he shares a story. But sometimes he talks about, like, his own religious experience or his own growing up in that mindset or growing up in that experience. And his own stand-up at times turns into a gospel. And not in the sense of he's getting up and going, all right, everyone, we're going to say a prayer. But in the sense of he will tell a message where it's a little preachy, but, like, gentle. Where he's like, guys, we need to come together as a nation. Guys, we need to do this, that. Or, like, guys, don't we see the pattern of history here? And at the same time, it doesn't feel, at least not to me, it doesn't feel like somebody going, by the way, I've also snuck in this timeshare. That's how I got you guys.
What you're describing with Josh Johnson, where he's able to do something that is entertaining and presumably usually actively comedic as opposed to just engaging, which just.
Yes.
But also covering some important or hefty stuff.
Yeah.
On your previous recommendation, I listened yesterday to The Great Depression. Gary Goldman.
Gary Goldman.
And I was struck by just how stark and honest his discussion of what his depression looked like was without ever feeling as though it weighed down the experience.
Right? He's so good at that.
Yeah. It was so honest and had the emotional effect, but without breaking pace.
I mean, that's a pro right there. And he's so humble about it, too, but he's such a well-oiled machine when it comes to his material. And I know he's got a lot of different things that he speaks honestly and openly about. And the struggles with depression, making that comedic. I mean, I always go back to the quote by, I think it's Anthony Jeselnik, who he's a comedian who he was talking more so about the line between offensive and canceled and all this stuff nowadays. And he said, comedy is getting away with it. Comedy is, people laugh at it. Like, comedy's getting away with it. If I get up and I tell a joke and people don't think it's funny, I've done my job incorrectly. I haven't gotten away with it. And that has stuck with me in a number of ways of, if you can talk about something profound or tragic or awful and make it still connect with people and make them feel lighter out the other side. It's not that you have to be like, oh, ha ha ha, 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, oh, shock value.
Right.
Because shock value, you can only get so far. It's when you can take something and point out the ridiculousness in the midst of it, of like, yeah, like the emperor's wearing no clothes. It's not good for the country, but isn't that ridiculous? And people be able to find brevity in the middle of some really hard things. That is the difference for me when I struggle with the Bo Burnham question of, should we really be laughing at a time like this? Mm-hmm. Of, is comedy helpful or is it just a distraction in the midst of the world falling apart? And when people say, actually, being able to laugh again after something terrible has happened is the first sign of healing. And you don't have to force yourself. Like, I'm not trying to force anyone to laugh, but I do think that being able to see the light and see the funny in the midst of it can be very healing and very, very much something that can save people.
Mm-hmm. And I think the in the midst is probably as, if not more important of like, not only if it's in the after, it can be a sign of healing beginning, but if it's in the midst, it can be a sign that healing can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And not to sound so all important, here I am. Like, I'm like, I've done open mic for 6 months. I think I'm healing the world. Yeah. Well, and that's, again, I think being self-critical, it's from all angles at all times. Mm. But that's hopefully part of what helps somebody, myself included, become better at comedy, to be able to see the different perspectives, to see, okay, what is funny about this situation, which can be a gift and a curse. There are multiple moments in my life where I shouldn't be laughing, where I'm like, oh, but wait, everyone look. And I'm like, no. I just stare straight forward.
And I think there are different kinds of value to the different kinds of way to make light, right?
Absolutely.
Where you have the Gary Goldman Great Depression style, where like you laugh while acknowledging the sadness,
yeah,
as opposed to the sort of kind of like every time a clip of, say, Weekend Update crosses me.
Oh.
Where that's the thing that I have
the cringe humor.
Often. Mm-hmm. Often. Mm-hmm. Where that's the thing I have to acknowledge about taste, right? Mm-hmm. Where it seems as though, I hope, for a lot of people, humor in the midst is a coping mechanism.
Absolutely.
Where for me, it doesn't help. So I know that is not for me. And talking about, you know, the value of quitting a thing, that's a form of quitting a thing, is knowing that thing is valid but not for me.
Absolutely. I think that's with like certain horror movies.
Oh yeah.
I can understand certain Stephen King movies where I go, absolutely, a work of art, pinnacle of its time, something that all works after it would build upon. I'm never going to watch it. And by it, I mean it, the actual clown movie.
So sticking on influences a little longer, you've named some specific people. Is it mostly a thing where you take influences via observation or – and I guess you've done this a little bit as well, where you pull certain quotes that are about the nature of comedy. But the question of learning by observation versus learning by philosophy or like rules of thumb –
I'm somebody who likes learning about the thing, which means that I have a bunch of hobbies I started and then realized I just liked learning about the hobby. It's like, oh, I liked Googling everything ahead of time. I don't think I actually wanted to do this. Whereas comedy is a weird one because anyone can try to make someone around them laugh. Anyone can try to make a joke in class or like with a teacher or a friend or a coworker, and you most of the time know whether it landed or not, but you don't know if they're laughing because they're like, ha, 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 okay, bye, and what they say after you walk away. And that can be an intimidating factor. I think doing is learning for a lot of the stuff when it comes to having jokes land. When it comes to what do I think is funny, I think a lot of that is in my own head. Like, I think that I do a lot of observing. I do a lot of seeing new material. Some comics are like, no, I never want to watch anyone else's comedy specials because I don't want to even accidentally copy anyone, or I don't want anyone to ever say, oh, well, you clearly were influenced by this. I love comedy. I'm going to keep watching stuff. I hope someone calls me out if I accidentally, I'm not purposefully trying to copy anyone's stuff or rip it off. If someone goes, hey, that joke sounded like so-and-so's joke, I'd be like, oh, shoot, let me change it.
Mm.
I think something that's helped me with that is I tell a lot of my jokes about my own personal experience. Mm. And so I know I can't be told I'm copying anyone else if it's a story about literally my own family that I lived through. It's sort of like the whole the liar situation of you don't have to worry about getting caught in a lie if you're always telling the truth,
mm-hmm.
which is a little bit of a lie because people misremember stuff all the time. But coming back to the question, I think most of my learning is just by doing. Like, I think a lot of how I get better at it, a lot how I grow in it, is by interacting with people around me and finding out, okay, did this joke land with this person? Did they think this is funny? What kind of person thought this was funny?
Mm.
And the more I interact with people and get to know them and find what they find funny, the more I feel like I can get up of a crowd of people who've never met me before, who I've never met, and say something that I think will connect with them.
Mm.
I think that's one of the areas in which I'm growing that I think I already had a bit of growth there, where I can read people decently well.
Mm.
I get stuff wrong all the time. It's not that I'm some magic person who can immediately understand what people are thinking or what they're about. I also do over-talk. I tend to talk too much. But I think I can come into a situation and go, okay, what is this person's niche interest? I'll know at least one random fact about that.
Mm.
And that has been very helpful when I like let myself have the space of, instead of the jokes I swore I was going to get up and tell, I will often get up and be like, who do we have here? What's going on here? I heard y'all talking to the other comics. What do you guys do? And that's actually been some of my moments where I most felt like I was killing it,
mm.
where I've leaned into, okay, wait, who do I have in front of me? What did they want to hear?
On loving learning about hobbies and like having a factoid for everything, how many Wikipedia tabs you got open right now?
We don't need to get into that. That's enough that I owe them money. Yeah, enough that like whenever the donation thing pops up each year, I'm like, yeah, I know. I do owe you money.
I should.
I should.
Talk about the person who like, or the kind of person who just avoids watching all comedy to not be influenced. That makes me a little sad on the basis that I presume they used to watch comedy.
Yeah.
But it makes me think of, don't remember which poet this was. There was a poet that I was introduced to a couple years ago who, she as a teenager, was writing these like excellent poems, and her like teachers or whoever around her were reading them were like, who do you read? And she was mm-hmm. like, I don't. I just write. Mm-hmm. And they went, you have to read.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to the poet's credit, she did. And she started reading way more, which the common thread is that you have to be a good reader to be a good writer,
yeah.
and B, to read more than you write.
Mm.
But at the same time, anything that prescriptive when you were already getting satisfaction out
yes.
of the thing, I don't know, man.
It can sometimes dampen the enthusiasm.
Yeah, because if that person was already not absorbing stand-up yep. comedy but was enjoying and even good at it, cool.
Have at it.
Continue not watching comedy, Mike,
yes.
I guess.
Yeah. Well, and it goes the other way. There are some people that you say, they say, oh, what are your influences? And you tell them and they go, oh, not so-and-so, not this person, not this person. And it can sort of feel like you're having a cool person party where everybody's just trying to cool off, where they're all trying to prove that they're the most influential or the most enlightened person in the circle.
That they can like pull out people that you yep. didn't think about.
Oh, absolutely. Or like, they're like, oh, well, who's your favorite SNL cast member?
Oh.
You're like, oh, no, it's one of these conversations. I'm not allowed to save Steve Martin. Like, that's the respectable choice, but I got him. John Belushi? I don't know.
Like one of those opinion-based but there's a wrong answer type questions?
Yeah. Name five of their songs where
oh,
you're like,
no.
Oh, no, I wore the wrong band shirt to this
mm-hmm,
venue.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, they're just looking for someone to connect with because that's why they got into comedy, is they're looking to connect with other people. And I have to remember, yeah, this is an awkward group of people.
Mm-hmm.
You walk in thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm going to get up here in front of all these experts. And I'm like, all of these people also woke up today and said this would be a fun thing to do. We're all losers. Like, that's okay. And if we all just accept that, we'll have a much better time.
Yeah.
But it's a good group, though.
On that point, Is there something that you have found or you have learned? Because obviously you've only done comedy for a little while. You've only done it in this region.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you've observed or that you've been told by others sort of characterizes the comedy scene here?
I've been told it's growing.
Oh.
That, and I think a lot of that is because we've had some big influences with people like Nate Bargatze.
Mm.
There's definitely been more interest in this region. Any comedy faces come into Nashville and making it bigger are great. I think they would have some tough competition with how strong Nate's group is, though. He has himself, Aaron, Brian, Dusty Slay. They're all like the original Natelyn. Well, I say the original. I think it was three at first. Now there's four. But like the Natelyn podcast that they've been doing, and the fact that like the shows they've been doing, and they're constantly elevating new comics. And there's a lot of talk about Nate Bargatze like making more of like venues or putting his name on stuff. And who knows how much of it's just rumors and speculation. But I think a big part of the Nashville community is people still knowing each other.
Mm-hmm.
People rooting for each other, and it being a more of a variety, though we could always use more variety than there is now. I think it's still sometimes the Rhinestone Mafia, which is a little bit straight and white, but I think that's a lot of Nashville industries, and there are plenty of people out there who are doing more diverse works and bringing more to the table than we've seen previously, but I don't know. I'm still exploring it.
Mm-hmm.
There are sides to it that I still haven't. I don't do a lot of late night mics just because of my 9-to-5. But I do enjoy the occasional times where I am able to scope out a mic I haven't tried before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did briefly allude very early on to your 9-to-5 being a lawyer.
Yes.
And as you mentioned earlier, like the fact that you stand up and talk in front of people as a job.
Yeah.
And then you do it elsewhere.
Yeah.
I do wonder, though, if the nature of the ways that you're talking in front of a group of people are so different those two things that, like, I wonder if that would be one of the draws to comedy for you of, like, you are getting, in an ideal world, such a different reaction from an audience than you would get as a lawyer.
It is so tricky to see the difference at times because it almost makes me upset because I stand up during my day job and talk to people in a, I guess, a side of me that is real, like lawyer Katie is real, but it's very put together, very professional, very here, just the facts, ma'am. It's very much, this is what we're here to do. We're here to do a job. We're here to get it done. And often people who I'm coming into contact with, aside from people who work in that system already, but most of the people I come into contact with are often the general public.
Mm.
And the general public wants you to just talk to them like a normal person. And so much of what I have to do is, well, excuse me, ma'am, excuse me, sir, here's what we're doing today. And I try to guide people through with as much of a human hand as possible of, like, we're trying to navigate the system. Let's get to the other side of it with minimal damage. I had a professor my first year of law school who was teaching us legal writing, and she said, okay, I've taught you. She was teaching us all these briefs. And then at a certain point in the class, she said, and now our next assignment is you're going to have to explain all this information to a family member in a letter. She goes, because you're all going to learn legal writing and you're going to forget how to talk like normal human beings. And that's a huge part of being able to be a lawyer because you need to be able to communicate this to people who are not going to understand where you're coming from, why you're using these terms, why you can't just say it like a normal person. And comedy is not just an amazing exercise in being able to connect with human beings on a human level. It is also, I think, just like a release, like just a relief to actually be myself again at the end of the day, because there's so much of, I do a lot of bad news conversations with people throughout the day where we're having to talk about hard things that have happened and consequences and what needs to happen next and whether or not people are doing their jobs. And then I can go and laugh about stuff that I cannot laugh about in a courtroom.
Right.
And say, and no, I'm not spilling anyone's business for legal reasons. This is a disclaimer. I'm not getting up there and saying, well, so-and-so went down to the courthouse today and they did this and this is all confidential, but I know you folks won't tell. I don't do any of that, but it's nice to be able to say, isn't this ridiculous? And granted, you can do that at court sometimes. You just have to be out of earshot of the judge. But there are times, I mean, there are plenty of times where I look at a clerk or another attorney or even client and sometimes a judge and go, this is ridiculous. And they go, yeah, but then we have to go back to being serious. Whereas it's nice to have a group of people where you go, this is ridiculous. And they go all, ha, oh my gosh, that is so ridiculous. And you're like, yes. Oh my gosh, okay, I'm glad we can laugh about it.
Yeah, I imagine that the difference there between like people you're working with and people that you just tell things to is a sort of sympathy-empathy type divide where like both is good.
Both is good. Part of it too is open mics will connect you with the community real fast. You're going to learn all about all the different places around you, all the people that are out and about, people who are the regular barflies, people who are just going out to... There have been so many people that are out on first dates at open mics.
Oh.
And every single time it's like, what a horrendous choice. What an awful choice you've made. This is a red flag, lady. Like, just take that into account. Who chose the venue? Him? Good luck. Like, unless you guys have an incredible sense of humor and are willing to just get absolutely lambasted. And they'll always sit way too close to the mic. You're like, good luck. You're just about to get asked so many questions about your personal life.
Right.
By just a stream of men in their early 20s.
So to that point, when you're doing open mics, how much is crowd work a factor? Is that built into your time? How does that work?
Depends on the crowd.
Yeah.
There are some places you go, it's comics and comics only. And those are hard. People are, I mean, stage time is stage time. You get your clips, you get your time, you get to work some stuff out, you see how things work, and you might get some good feedback, but the more of an actual authentic crowd it is, the more I've enjoyed it. And the more I think it pulls in comics because they say, oh, so and such, Grandpa Bar, Friday nights, early mic, they always have people who are there who aren't comics, even if it's filled with comics, but it's filled with comics because they know other people will show.
Okay.
And the more you have genuine reactions, because some of us, we've heard this dude's jokes 20 times. I still think they're funny, but I've heard it 20 times for the last 15 weeks. Whereas these people are hearing it for the first time. And so you really get to see, okay, how's this about to go? Some people don't do a lick of crowd work. Some people build it in out of necessity, because especially people who are more established on social media, crowd work has seen a real big upward trend as far as I've seen of like getting engagement. And maybe that just stems from that same principle that we've seen, that trend of people wanting more real, and crowd work feels very real, even though there's always going to be someone in the comments being like, this person was planted. It's like, who knows? I'm gonna tell you, if my husband's there, he's my plan. I know I can get a joke. Well, because, and I will be the, like, I'm not, like, let me clear this up. I'm not the plant for anything. But when I'm at a show and it's comics and everyone's telling all these jokes that we've heard before, I will be a good crowd member. I think that is almost just as important to being involved in the comic scene or the comedian scene anywhere. Of, you can't just be good at getting up and doing your jokes. You have to be a good supporter of the jokes. And I'm like, I'm gonna laugh just as hard at stuff I think is funny the 13th time I've heard it. I'm gonna, if someone's like, does anyone here have this? If it's quiet for a second, I'll shout out an answer because I know you need that. I know you need that next step. I know you're waiting for that. I know this will get your flow going. And the last thing we want to do is sit here in silence. Does that also stem from the fact that I was the kid in class growing up that they were like, does anyone have an answer? And my little meaty hand was going to shoot up and like, yes. It's like, all right, let someone else give a turn.
And you were talking earlier about how people want authentic feeling comedy, at least in North American circuit, as you've observed. But that, my immediate thought was, doesn't that only matter if you can tell? Doesn't that only matter if it's, if you're taken out of it enough that it doesn't feel authentic?
I do wonder.
And to the same point of like, does it matter if that person's a plant if the joke is still good?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think if it gets the laughs, it gets the laughs. Now, granted, are there things that people laugh at that I don't think is funny? Absolutely. All the time. Are there things that people are like, oh, that's authentic? And I'm like, that's fake as all get out. What do you mean? To each their own, I suppose. But I will say that the more that people can, like, the thing that's authentic the most is the connection. And the more you can connect with whoever's in front of you, that's the authenticity I think people are craving. And here's the thing. Most people in their lifetime maybe go to like 2-3 comedy shows. Like, it's an extracurricular that they might choose to do as like a fun one-time event sometimes. And the idea that there's a group of just insane people who are spending their weeks going to show, hearing the same jokes again and again and again, trying to hone their craft, that is crazy. And the fact that they're doing it to try to connect with people who aren't at these shows. Mm. I think that there's something to be studied there. But at the same time, I do think it has helped me. Mm. I think it has helped me be more aware of people around me. It has helped me be more aware of the ways to connect and different people's perspectives, even with jokes that I don't think are funny, even jokes that I'm like, oh, that wasn't for me. I've still learned something about that person. I've seen comics invite their parents to things where they are fully, I saw a comic do a whole bit about his parents' sex life.
Oh, no.
And they were both there. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, man, y'all must be healthy. Like, either you're the healthiest relationship dynamic I've ever seen, mm-hmm. or this is the final straw. Like, you're about to have a full car ride back fighting about this.
Yeah.
And there's no in between. There can't be. I'm so impressed by it at the same time. And there's something, I don't know. I feel like every year I get older, I get a little less afraid of what people think of me.
That's the hope.
And I'm still terrified. But I'm getting better at it. And I think I am drawn to things where I have improved in not caring.
Mm.
And not in a way, I never want to become a person who doesn't care what people think,
mm-hmm.
because I think that that's still something that's fundamentally important to me. But I do want to care how people feel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to dictate the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think comedy is a very interesting balancing act with that for me, because you have to care. You also have to have fun. And so I have to get up and think it's funny, and I want them to think it's funny too.
Uh-huh.
And that has been something that has helped me realize, okay, why do I think this thing is funny? I think it's funny because of this. Other people aren't laughing at it. Oh, a big one for that was when I first started out and I was really trying to figure out, okay, what kind of jokes am I drawn to? I started making jokes about my appearance.
Hmm.
And they weren't landing. And I thought, well, these have always landed in my family growing up. Why is it not working with the crowd? And it was because they didn't see me how I saw me.
Hmm.
And I was being real self-degrading. And people didn't think it was funny. And I had to accept the fact that I might be much better looking. No, I'm just kidding. I had to accept the fact that my jokes weren't going to land because I thought I was worse looking than the audience would buy into.
Hmm.
And if they're not willing to buy into that joke, then it's not going to land. And I couldn't, as hard as I tried. Now, I realize this has turned into me talking about how I look, and that's always a shaky ground. But I didn't know what to do with that because I was also struggling with the fact that I was taking videos of myself,
mm-hmm.
which I never did before. And I was seeing myself from all these angles and going, well, I'm never wearing those pants again. And so I thought, oh, perfect. I'm going to make a joke about that. I'll turn this thing that could be a prickly point in my heart into comedy. But then I was telling a joke about it and people were like, I was like, why aren't y'all thinking this is hilarious? I'm joking about this thing. Aren't I so funny and self-deprecating? And it was like, no. Yeah, we don't see you that way.
And do you think that was the audience that was receiving it or the way you were telling it or some of both?
Oh, I'm sure some of both. I'm sure if I fine-tuned it enough and got a better angle on it. I've heard people do self-deprecating jokes about appearance,
yeah.
in a way that's very creative, very hysterical. I've realized that there are certain things that you really have to nail. You can't just do very generalized jokes.
Hmm.
Some crowds will accept a broad joke, like a very, like, what some people would call hack comedy. But for people who are making those hack jokes, which, again, I would argue that a hack joke is just whether or not you can get away with it. The people who making those jokes are often just trying to find something that'll land.
Hmm.
But it's tricky. You have to go a bit more niche than that. And it's, I mean, every crowd is different. Every group is different, unless it's the same group of comics you see every week at the same bar. But I think it's kind of fun. This thing I do for fun. The thing I think that's the most fun about it is that it's ever changing.
Yeah.
I think it's the same reason I got into my career is I knew if I picked a job that was the same every day, I was going to lose my mind.
Mm.
And so I guess it's funny that I've also picked a hobby that changes every time.
Yeah. We alluded to comics sort of giving at shows.
Mm.
What does it look like for a straight audience member, like, to be a good audience member at a comedy show?
Be willing to laugh.
Yeah.
I think so many people are nervous of being the one laughing in a room, or mm. they're looking around to see how other people are reacting. I don't know if it's always been like that. I don't know if we're just so aware of being perceived at all times. People often look over, see that someone's filming with a phone, and that immediately changes how they're about to react.
Yeah.
Being perceived is hard.
Mm.
But laugh loud. Enjoy the show. Clap. Like, call out answers. Don't heckle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a call and response. Don't shout something if you're not supposed to. Granted, are there comics who someone shouts out something at a weird time and they turn that into the funniest bit of the night, yes. But that's the comic skill in that moment. That wasn't because you heroically dove out there and said something hilarious.
Yeah, that There's, should not be an expectation that yes. the comic can respond. I think that's about all the time we've got.
Oh, no. Okay.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
And thank you all for listening. As always, the show is brought to you because of the Nashville Public Library. So whether you're listening in Nashville or beyond, find your public library, get a library card, and use it. Because the best way to support your library is to let it support you with all the goods and services they offer. I bet there's more than you think. Thank you very much.